The Security Committee will come back to order. Senator Lori, which bill you want first?
Actually, I've only got one. I'm going to take up 3780. We just worked with all of the stakeholders, and we can take whatever that other one was off the agenda. We're going to be good with that. Don't need legislation.
Wonderful.
So we have Senate File 3780 before us, and what this is a bill for optometrists and their ability to utilize some emerging technology. It is about emerging technology, really, where they're beginning to come up with, and the FDA is about ready to approve contact lenses with some of the things that they put in that you use for drops.
Eye drops.
Right now, eye drops you put in your eye. They prevent irritation and whatnot, and then you put the contacts in. Now they've kind of put these things right in the contacts, and so what this bill does is it allows the optometrist to not only prescribe these contact lenses with the medicines in them, but they can also dispense these. Right now there's a current bar from an optometrist dispensing Legend drugs, and these would be considered Legend drugs, but there's a narrow exemption from the prohibition where it would say unless the Legend drug is within the scope, so it is clearly within the scope of practice of the optometrists, and is administered to the eye through a contact lens that is intended to correct vision. So really what this is, you know, patients are coming to optometrists for contact lenses, and some of them can have some of the medicines that they need to help alleviate irritation and whatnot built right into them. And if we don't act on our current statute, they would be barred from actually dispensing these contact lenses as they do with current contacts. This is a measure that is supported by all three stakeholders, the optometrists, the ophthalmologists, and the pharmacists. I have letters of support from both the Board of Pharmacy and the Minnesota Pharmacy Association. I don't have a letter, but I think somebody from the Board of Ophthalmology was going to be here earlier tonight. I don't know if they're here for a statement of support. But really, there is no opposition. We're going to allow ophthalmologists who are prescribing contact lenses with the medicines in them that just help be able to dispense them on site within the scope of their existing practice.
Is there anybody in the audience who wanted to speak to this bill? Any questions from the committee? Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, you're saying ophthalmologist and the bill is optometrist, and they're two different practices.
Mm-hmm. It's optometrists.
Thank you.
I am sorry. The optometrist is able to prescribe and dispense under this bill, and the ophthalmologist is okay with that. And it is within the optometrist's current scope of practice to prescribe but they wouldn't be able to dispense. And these are emerging technologies. Again, these don't exist right now, but the FDA is about ready to approve these for use. And if we do this, then there's going to be, if we don't do this, there'll be a little bit of a difficulty in starting to get these up. I mean, the pharmacists are able to dispense a prescription for contact lenses, but they don't do it. I mean, the optometrists dispense contact lenses, and this is a new breed moving forward, and it's a narrow exemption from the prohibition that is agreed to, again, by the pharmacists, the ophthalmologists, who are different from the optometrists, who are seeking this additional little piece.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, give me another minute, and I'll think of another question that will really trip your tongue as you're trying to go through it.
It won't be hard.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori. Senator Lori, thank you for being proactive on this.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 3780 be recommended to pass.
I don't get to move my own bill?
I was just trying to be expedient.
Senator Lynch moves the bill for Senator Lori. Is there further discussion on the bill? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have one bill left. It's going to take a little more time, but I think I would like to have us be out of here by 7:30 if we can. We've told proponents and opponents they will each get 15 minutes to present their cases. And we have Department of Health, we told them they could present their review first. And Senator Salzman, do you want to say anything at the beginning, or would you like to? Health Department first. Okay, well, who's here from Health Department? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Golden. I am the director for the Division of Health Policy with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here today to present the results of the Health Department's review of the proposal to build a specialty psychiatric hospital in Woodbury, Minnesota. In November of 2007, the Department of Health received a proposal to build a specialty psychiatric hospital in Woodbury, Minnesota. The request that is before the legislature is to enact a law that would allow for the construction of a hospital with up to 144 beds, specifically for psychiatric and chemical dependency services, although the hospital would begin operations with 96 beds. Based on information provided to the department by Prairie St. John's, the proposed hospital would serve about 3,400 patients per year after the initial year of operation and grow to about 5,100 per year upon expansion to the full 144-bed capacity. This table shows the breakdown of the proposed beds by type of service and age. Of the initial 96 beds, 63 would be specifically for psychiatric care, and of those, 42 would serve children and adolescents. 12 beds would be devoted to chemical dependency services for adults, and 21 beds would serve adults with co-occurring psychiatric and chemical dependency conditions. Prairie St. John's did not provide specific details on how the 48 Phase 2 expansion beds would be allocated by age and type of service. As you're probably well aware, the statute that created the public interest review requires the department to consider five specific factors in its review of proposals. These factors are whether the new hospital or hospital beds are needed to provide timely access to care, the financial impact of the new hospital or hospital beds on existing acute care hospitals, how the new hospital or hospital beds will affect the ability of existing hospitals in the region to maintain existing staff, and the extent to which the new hospital or hospital beds will provide services to non-paying or low-income patients, and then also, finally, the views of affected and relevant parties. Most committee members are probably already aware that the department's finding in this review was that the proposal is not in the public interest. I'll spend most of the rest of my presentation telling you how we reached this conclusion. But first, let me make a couple of things clear. First, the department finding does not mean that there are no problems with the mental health system in Minnesota. There are clearly problems, many problems that exist today, including patients having to travel long distances to receive care, waiting for extended periods in hospital emergency rooms, and many other frustrating experiences. The many personal stories that people shared with us during our review process are evidence that the system today fails to serve many patients well. Second, the finding is not a conclusion that there is no need for additional inpatient mental health beds in Minnesota, nor is it a conclusion that it is acceptable for patients to have to travel long distances to receive care. The report concludes that the scale of Prairie St. John's proposal is large relative to the documented need, which is not the same thing as saying that there is no need. And finally, this report is not a research study of Minnesota's mental health system with policy recommendations about how much additional capacity is needed or where that might be needed. One of the first things that we did for this review was collect the most complete and current data that is available on current hospital capacity for psychiatric and chemical dependency services. We did this by calling every hospital in Minnesota that operates a psychiatric or chemical dependency unit and asking them how many beds are in their unit and how many of those are currently staffed and how many new beds are coming online in 2008. We also analyzed information from a hospital discharge database that includes every hospital in Minnesota. We focused in particular on travel patterns for psychiatric and chemical dependency care compared to other types of care, since having to travel long distances to receive care has been a matter of public concern. For this study, we were able to use information from the Minnesota Hospital Association, which has obtained through partnerships with hospital associations in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa, to add to our understanding of where Minnesotans go to receive their care. The public input part of the review included public notice to interested parties soliciting comments on the proposal, a letter to hospital administrators in the Twin Cities, and to hospital administrators throughout the state. We also held a public hearing in Woodbury on January 22nd. That hearing was attended by approximately 75 to 100 people, and we received 27 written comments on the proposal from healthcare providers, organizations, and interested parties. In our analysis of the first criteria listed in the law, we looked at the following questions. What is the current hospital capacity and utilization for psychiatric and chemical dependency services? What evidence is there for need for new capacity? How does the mix of services at the proposed hospital compare with those needed services? And are there alternatives to new beds that might be more appropriate to serve those patients? As I noted earlier, we collected complete and up-to-date information on mental health beds from all hospitals in Minnesota that have dedicated units, including community hospitals and state-operated facilities. In total, we counted 1,365 psychiatric beds, including 32 that are being added in the Twin Cities in 2008, and 415 chemical dependency beds, including four that are being added at St. Joseph's in 2008. This works out to approximately 29.4 psychiatric beds per 100,000 in the Twin Cities and 25.8 per 100,000 in the state. For chemical dependency, there are approximately 4.9 beds per 100,000 and 7.9 statewide. In total and in the Twin Cities, the number of mental health beds per 100,000 population is very similar to the national average figures that are cited in Prairie St. John's application. Although, as you would note in our materials, we had some concerns about that particular data source, and that was the reason that we did this survey of all hospitals. In terms of how those beds split out by age group, statewide there are 157 psychiatric beds for children and adolescents, and 91 of these are in the Twin Cities metro area. There are 57 chemical dependency beds for adolescents statewide, and 27 of these are in the Twin Cities. For adults, there are 1,088 psychiatric beds statewide, with about 69 of this total in the Twin Cities metro area. There are 351 chemical dependency beds, with about a third of those in the Twin Cities. Since there are no agreed-upon benchmarks for what constitutes the right number of mental health inpatient beds, our analysis took the approach of looking at the evidence we have about potential shortages of beds and the need for more beds. We analyzed how often people who live in different regions of the state travel to inpatient psychiatric and chemical... Basically, we analyzed how often people who live in different regions of the state had to travel to receive inpatient psychiatric and chemical dependency care and compared that to how often they had to travel for hospitalizations for other conditions. In most part of the state, it is true that people are more likely to travel outside of their region when they are hospitalized for psychiatric or chemical dependency conditions compared to when they are hospitalized for other conditions. So looking at this chart, Twin Cities residents are hospitalized in their own region about 90% of the time when they need care for psychiatric or chemical dependency conditions. This compares to 97% of the time for other conditions. In other parts of the state, residents are much more likely to travel outside of their region for care, including hospital care. This is not surprising in the Northwest, West Central, or Southwest regions, where the closest large cities are in North Dakota and South Dakota. In the Central region, people receive care for psychiatric and chemical dependency conditions in their region only about 60% of the time, and many of those people end up traveling to the Twin Cities. Here you see the same type of chart for adolescents and children. What you see here is data that is very similar to what we saw for the population overall. I mentioned before that many patients from other regions of the state and outside the state traveled to the Twin Cities to receive psychiatric and chemical dependency hospital care. For example, in 2006, about 2,000 psychiatric admissions at Twin Cities hospitals were for people who live outside of the Twin Cities region. And the same was true for the Twin Cities for hospital chemical dependency admissions as well. What this slide does is compares the total number of days of inpatient care provided by the hospitals in a region to the total number of days of care provided to residents of that region. And what you can see is in the Twin Cities, hospitals provide about 5,600 more days of psychiatric care than the total number of days of care that region residents received anywhere. In other words, Twin Cities hospitals currently provide a volume of services that exceed the volume of services that are being used by region residents. This suggests that to the degree that there is a problem of insufficient hospital capacity, it's not necessarily a problem of insufficient capacity in the Twin Cities, but perhaps in other regions of the state. As you can see from this slide, that in the four regions of the state, Central, Northwest, Southeast, and West Central, hospitals provide fewer days of psychiatric care than the total days of care needed by that region's residents. With the exception of the Central region, these areas are in the western parts of the state where the closest access to a city is across state lines to North or South Dakota, and where people typically travel for any number of activities, including additional health care. Moving to the second criterion for evaluating the proposal, the financial impact on existing hospitals. Many members of the community may be aware of a public debate that occurred whether Prairie St. John's could accept Medicaid payments for adult, non-elderly patients. This is because a freestanding inpatient mental health hospital with more than 16 beds is considered an institution for mental diseases, or an IMD under federal law. The state generally is prohibited from receiving federal matching funds for non-elderly adults who are treated at IMDs. However, the Department of Human Services has clarified that this prohibition only applies to Medicaid beneficiaries who are enrolled in the fee-for-service Medicaid program. In addition, DHS currently pays for services provided to these beneficiaries at IMDs with 100% state funds through a program called Program IM. There will be an impact on the state budget when services are paid with 100% state money instead of receiving federal matching funds. But Prairie St. John's has committed to accepting all patients from all payers. One additional concern has been raised about the proposal's financial impact on existing hospitals, and that has to do with the proposed hospital's limited ability to treat medically complex patients. Because the facility would only be able to treat the least complex patients, the average level of complexity of patients who are treated at existing hospital psychiatric and chemical dependency units will rise. And because hospitals are paid a flat fee per admission based on patients' diagnosis, an increase in the average level of medical complexity of patients served at existing hospitals will likely have a negative financial impact on those existing hospitals.
Mr. Golden?
Yes.
When you were talking about the impact on the budget for medical assistance not paying, did you do any fiscal notes or estimates of what that would be?
Mr. Chair, we had some communications with the Department of Human Services. We didn't have that in the report. They were still working on that. I believe that DHS would have that information and be able to comment on that for you. Looking at factor three, with regard to the ability of existing hospitals to maintain their workforce, it's important to consider this proposal in the broader context of significant mental health professional workforce shortages that currently exist in Minnesota and in many parts of the nation. 70 of Minnesota's 87 counties are designated mental health professional shortage areas. And although this does not include the Twin Cities, the proposed new hospital would create additional competition for existing mental health professional workforce in the Twin Cities and in other parts of the state. In previous hospital public interest reviews, the department has compared the size of the proposed new facility to the total size of hospital capacity in the relevant area as a measure of how significantly the proposal would affect existing hospitals' ability to maintain their workforce. In this case, because the workforce needed at a specialty hospital requires a specific, specialized set of skills, we believe that it is most appropriate to compare the proposal to existing inpatient mental health capacity in the Twin Cities. Compared to the number of existing hospital mental health beds in the Twin Cities, the proposal represents an increase of approximately 15% in the total number of beds. This is fairly large, especially when considered in the context of the difficulty that many hospitals currently have been reporting in recruiting and retaining mental health professionals. Prairie St. John's indicated that it intended to recruit its workforce from the proposed hospital, primarily from out of state, but it is not clear how the new hospital would be so much more successful in attempting to attract mental health professionals from outside of Minnesota than the existing hospitals have been thus far. The fourth factor that the department must consider in its review is the degree to which the proposed hospital will provide services to non-paying or low-income patients relative to existing hospitals. This table provides information on charity care, bad debt, and total uncompensated care by Minnesota hospitals, Twin Cities hospitals, and by Prairie St. John's at its current specialty hospital in Fargo. As a percentage of operating expense in 2006, Minnesota hospitals incurred about 2% of their operating expense as uncompensated care, including about 0.9% as charity care and 1.1% as bad debt. The best comparison that we were able to make with information provided by Prairie St. John's was that 6.9% total uncompensated care, including 0.7% charity care and 6.2% bad debt. I should note that this is not a completely apples-to-apples comparison for two reasons. First, because Prairie St. John's is in the process of reclassifying some of its bad debt as charity care for 2006. And second, because Prairie St. John's includes discounts provided to self-pay patients as bad debt, while Minnesota hospitals are required to report these discounts separately. Finally, I spoke earlier about the many personal stories that we heard in the process of doing this review. We heard from patients and families about the difficulties in getting timely and appropriate mental health care, including long waits in emergency rooms, traveling long distances to be admitted to a hospital, and other frustrating experiences. We also heard from several rural hospitals that reported receiving many patients from the Twin Cities and many phone calls looking for available beds. From Twin Cities hospitals that currently provide mental health services, we heard concerns about the financial impact of the proposed hospital on them, concerns about the inability of the proposed hospital to care for medically complex patients, and concerns about the impact on their ability to maintain their workforces. Finally, we also heard many comments about the need for an integrated approach to mental health services, including investments in intermediate resources that would reduce the need for hospitalizations and reduce unnecessarily long inpatient stays. We heard from law enforcement and emergency medical services about the burden that transporting patients to distant facilities can place on their budget and staff resources. And finally, we received several comments about Prairie St. John's as a good corporate citizen and the potential positive impact of the proposed hospital on the city of Woodbury. The primary conclusions of the public interest review are as follows. Minnesota's mental health system does not always serve patients well for many of the reasons that I've discussed already. One of the actions that has been taken to address this is the action that the 2007 legislature took to enact some major mental health initiatives, including funding for some of those intermediate levels of care. Available evidence does not necessarily indicate insufficient capacity in the Twin Cities. Currently, Twin Cities hospitals have provided more days of care than are currently needed by the region's residents, with a substantial inflow from the central region. With the existing beds coming on and the strategies to increase intermediate resources, we believe that there's substantial potential to free up the current inpatient capacity. Third, the scale of the proposal is large relative to the documented need. The hospital is designed to serve about 3,400 patients initially and go to 5,100 patients in phase two. A total of only 2,600 patients traveled outside of the region to receive care in 2006. And of those 2,600, 1,400 could be served by the additional beds that are currently being added in 2008. And if the strategies that the legislature has already passed to reduce the hospital need through more intermediate resources were to fail, even if those were to fail, the scale of the proposed exception is 3 to 4 times the level of documented need. The inability to accept medically complex patients is a concern and would likely have a negative impact on existing hospitals. Compared to adding capacity at an existing full-service hospital, this proposal would have a negative impact on the state budget. And to a significant degree, current lack of timely and appropriate mental health care is driven by workforce shortages, and that the proposed hospital is sufficiently large that it is likely to have a negative impact on the existing hospital's ability to maintain their staff. And as you can see from the contact information, I am presenting for Ms. Sonier, who, as the director of the Health Economics Program, did the study for us and had family obligations for this evening. With that, we would be more than happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Golden? Thank you very much. You'll be around in case people come up with questions later.
We certainly will, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Senator Salzman.
And I want to thank you, members, Mr. Chair, for being here tonight to hear this bill. It's very important. As you know, there was a study done, and I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some other ways of perhaps looking at this report. As a lobbyist for many years, I always told parents who I worked with that you look at spreadsheets and you see numbers. And numbers are not always easy to look at, but they're simple to look at. It's what do those numbers mean and what is the impact on real people. And so tonight, I hope that you'll give us some time to just listen to what is really happening in this community. I just heard this report from the health department, and something really stuck out with me, and that was the current system fails to serve many patients well. And certainly that the report documents, talks about numbers, but we continue to hear heart-wrenching stories of when the system has not served people very well at all. We've read the headlines. We hear about a mentally ill man who stabbed his mother to death before killing himself. And then in Mankato, a mentally ill man ran around in zero-degree weather, was shot and killed by the police after they said he threatened them with a knife. The next day, his brother was quoted as saying, "Why did they have to kill him? He wasn't a criminal. He was mentally ill." You've heard these stories before, and I know in this community you hear them much more than I do, about care delayed, care denied, patients sitting in emergency rooms for days before being transferred hundreds of miles away. The EMS Regulatory Board issued a report card last year that found that mental health patients travel for care more than all other patients combined. And that's the wrong way to really deliver service in this very critical area. In fact, it's an outrage, and we can do better. And that's why I'm here today with Senate File 3429. We are going to be hearing from a number of our care providers tonight who are concerned about this bill. And I would ask, what have they always done to address the need for beds? We've heard way too often of 100 beds have been cut since the year 2000, while hospitals have invested in more profitable centers. We hear about a medical arms race in healthcare, and members in mental health were experiencing a real crisis. With all due respect to the health department, and I truly appreciate the important work that they did, there's things that we need to be aware of, and that's that it's not okay for thousands of patients and their family members to be shipped around the upper Midwest. We don't tell women in labor to wait for days in an emergency room to be admitted. We don't tell men suffering from heart attacks that they need to be transferred hundreds of miles away to get care. We would be outraged if we were told to take our child home from the ER after he needed 150 stitches to stop the bleeding from a suicide attempt because there was no room in the hospital. But that is what is happening to mentally ill patients. In the health department report, it talked about 2,600 people are traveling to other regions of the state for psychiatric and CD care, and that is simply not acceptable. So I'd like you to listen to the stories tonight and look at the Department of Health report and hear about the true need that is still there. And certainly they have attempted to study this by looking at the numbers and talking about the potential for how legislation passed will address this issue. But are those services going to come soon enough? Prairie St. John's is a psychiatric hospital, and they serve patients very well. Why reject their infusion of private resources because the state can't afford to do its part this year? We hear from a number of organizations, from the Sheriff's Department, from the Minnesota Medical Association, from the EMS Regulatory Board, about the need for additional beds. So I hope you listen to these stories. And then I want to share an image that I have, is that when I visited the Prairie St. John inpatient facility, we were in a conference room, and there was a video monitor there. And that's how, for many parents whose children are being, you know, shipped around the state to Fargo, perhaps to their other facility to receive care, that's how they stay in contact with their children. And so we talk about community-based care. We talk about family involvement. And then think about it, if it was your child and your way of being able to stay in touch with them is by watching them on a video monitor. So that's my image of this and why I support this legislation. And I truly appreciate the fact that the health department did a very important report. I hope that you listen to the stories and perhaps hear the other side of this as well. At this time, I have Mr. Todd Johnson, who has a child who he wants to tell you about. So Mr. Johnson.
And now we'll start the 15 minutes for each side, so if people, testifiers, can keep touch with that for their own sake. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm pretty nervous. I've never spoken in public forum before, so bear with me. My name is Todd Johnson. I live in Woodbury. My wife and I are both nurses and have 38 years of combined experience in the medical profession. I'm not CEO or administrator or director of this or that, and no one is paying me to be here tonight. But I am a parent, and I come as a parent and as a brother and a nurse. When you have a loved one who is in a crisis situation, life or death, you want to bring them to the closest and best facility to treat them. My stepdaughter, Sarah, had two crisis situations here within the last year. Both times, police were called. First time, she wanted to kill herself. We brought her to the emergency room that night. We sat in there for about 4 or 5 hours with no eval from any psychiatrist. Eventually, we were roomed into a med-surg bed for the next 3 days with no psych eval at a local hospital here. Eventually, she was moved to a facility in the cities and was there for about a week. That's quite humiliating when you're sitting in the hospital room for 3 days, missing work, and you're expecting something to show up and nobody does. The second crisis was that she wanted to kill everybody in the family, and she came at me in the hallway with a knife. I took the knife away from her and restrained her until the police came. The police had called around. There were no beds available. So he gave us a card to call a doctor, a psychiatrist, the next day to get a referral. We did that, and they were able to take her, but she wouldn't be seen for about a year because that was the availability for that psychiatrist. So that same day, we called Prairie St. John's. We did an intake over the phone, and we brought her up there that same day, and she was brought into the hospital. It was a huge expense on our part to drive up there and take off work, and very stressful financially and emotionally, this process. I wanted to talk also about my brother Tommy, who is very strong-minded, successful businessman. Last person in the world I ever thought would ever have a crisis, emotionally or psychologically. Well, he did. It involved a suicide, and because he felt responsible, he wanted to do the same. His wife called me the next day. Me and one of his best friends went down there, picked him up. It's a 12-hour drive, brought him back here. We had made arrangements to bring him to a facility here in the Twin Cities, but they wanted the cash up front because he didn't have an adequate insurance. So that was not an option. I called around for look for psych beds, especially psych beds, because he was ready to go back home because he wasn't willing to put up with all this BS. I told him, let me make one more phone call. There were no psych beds available in the Twin Cities. I called Prairie St. John's, did an interview over the phone. We brought him up there that same evening, and he was admitted into the hospital. He is there right now. He is in residential care. He's not no longer in the hospital lockdown. He is in residential care, and he's being seen every day. When I talked to him last, he said the last time he was in a facility like this, about just several months prior to this, same scenario. He was there 2 weeks, went home, supposed to have follow-up, never did. He said the difference between that place and Prairie St. John's is night and day as far as how they treat him and what they do in the program that they have up there. And so finally, as a nurse, I've seen the way people are treated, brought to the hospital. I've worked in different ERs. I've worked for all three or contracted out through all three of the health systems that are here tonight. And I know what it's like, and I've seen it. And it's embarrassing for these people. It's embarrassing for the families to go through this and be looked at like you're some psychopath. And it's unfair. And I thank God for Prairie St. John's, because if they wouldn't have taken my brother in, I truly believe he'd be dead today. And I want to thank you very much, and we need beds here, because hospitals are built for crises, for immediate care, and there's nothing available here every time we've had personally experienced this situation. So we need Prairie St. John's, because they specialize in this, and they do a great job. And I've been doing this for 20-some years in the medical profession, and I haven't seen anybody do, and I've seen little change in the current system do anything about changing any of this stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Who's next? Go ahead now.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Shalene Kennedy. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I'm here as a cry for help from my colleagues as well as my patients who endure pain and suffering due to the lack of inpatient psychiatric beds. I have 3 points I'd like you to take away tonight. First of all, we need beds desperately now. I'm really disappointed that the Department of Health data does not represent what happens more often in ERs, which is the patients come in because they need to be put inpatient, and they actually are told they have to go so far that they refuse and they go home. That happens much more often. So if there's 2,600 that are having to go out of state, I would ask you to at least triple and probably quadruple that for the amount of people that go home. I personally challenge anyone who says we don't need psychiatric beds desperately now. I'd have them tell that to the mother from St. Paul who sat for 3 days in a local ER with a broken rib inflicted by her son, who was psychotic and violent, only to be transferred finally out of desperation to Prairie St. John's in Fargo. She returned to tell me it was the best thing they'd ever done. Tell that to the family from Burnsville, whose special needs aggressive child was taken 6 times to local ERs and told either to send him 80-plus miles away or take him home. They kept taking him home. He was finally admitted the seventh time, but only after taking a knife and seriously wounding his mother. Tell that to the mother from Shakopee in my office last week, badly scratched, bruised, by whose child also tried to assault myself and my nurse, who has been trying to get a psychiatric bed for the last 10 days. And what has happened in the last 10 days? While that child has been home, Mom has had to take off of work, and I have been managing this child by phone. Does it sound crazy? That's because it is. This is not good medicine, but what choice do I have? I am proof of why you don't have enough child psychiatrists in Minnesota. Who wants this job? Who wants these working conditions where you have no backup? If a child had an appendicitis as his emergency, would he ever be sent home to be managed by phone by his physician or sent 80-plus miles away? I ask you, could you sleep at night tonight if your child was home and violent or wanting to take their own life? That is why 24-hour inpatient care is necessary and cannot be substituted by outpatient or crisis intervention services. I do appreciate these services, and they're excellent when they work, but some things just can't be serviced that way. My second point is that to me, Prairie St. John's means quality, ethical, and medically flexible care for my patients. In the last 2 years, over 30 of my own outpatients have been treated at Prairie, inpatient or partial hospital. I've recommended them to family, friends in crisis, and my outpatients whose insurance was not covered there were taken pro bono. My medically complex patients were worked with at Prairie St. John's, despite being turned away by local hospitals. If my child needed treatment today, and three of my four are special needs, and they could be, I would take them to Prairie St. John's. My last point is I have seen Prairie try to be a part of the solution to the mental health care crisis on many levels, not just inpatient. This facility will not only have inpatient, but partial hospital, outpatient, crisis assessment, the ultimate continuity of care. Currently, Prairie St. John's offers free continuing medical education to physician and healthcare professionals to increase psychiatric knowledge in the community. They have me work with pediatricians, and I spent 6 hours on the phone with pediatricians yesterday to help manage difficult patients, to increase their comfort with treating psychiatric patients, to aid with treatment in earlier stages. They also offer free screening tools in schools and free needs assessments now for adults and children to get appropriate care, even not with Prairie. Again, briefly, my 3 points. We need these beds now. Prairie St. John's means quality and flexibility, particularly medically. And Prairie St. John's is already making strides to be part of the long-term solution. Please, I beg you, don't turn your backs on me or my patients. Please approve this mental health care campus and be proud that you are a part of at least the start of the solution. I know I am.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Ryan, and I am the Special Projects Liaison for Prairie St. John's. I'm only going to have time to briefly go over the points, but I would point you to the pamphlet that we've produced for you, as well as our letters of support, with the MMA letter being on top. As we have heard, this issue isn't about statistics. It's about real people who need help and too often don't get it. Having said that, we need to cut through the numbers and take a look at why the Department of Health came to the shocking conclusion that we need so few psychiatric beds. Currently, 1 in 10 Twin Cities patients is forced to travel outside the metro for inpatient hospitalization, according to MDH statistics. Untold thousands are told, go home. There aren't any beds. This is not the right care at the right time by the right provider. And contrary to the MDH report, our proposed 84 beds, and yes, it is 84 beds now, will not create an oversupply of inpatient psychiatric services in the Twin Cities. It will be a drop in the bucket. So who supports adding beds? Well, the Minnesota Ombudsman for Mental Health, Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Psychiatric Society top the list. There are others. And we reanalyzed the MDH finding using 3 separate yet mutually confirming methods: national comparison data, occupancy rate projections, and rationing corrections. Details are in the handout, but they all converge on what the MMA, MPS, and many others have said for years. We need more beds. We need a lot more beds. Note that our proposed facility won't even meet one-third of this need. This is what the research on our occupancy rates shows. With our current 93% occupancy rate in the Twin Cities, we turn away people far too often. All the people in the vertical striped area in this graph are turned away or are shipped hundreds of miles away by an ambulance to an available bed. And this was MDH's blind spot. We don't have numbers to quantify the unmet need. We only have what people in the trenches all across the state live every day. So this is the end result. Twin Cities patients clogging up beds in smaller rural hospitals, having to travel hundreds of miles to get there, or making the decision not to go at all. And this is accurate data on the Minnesota Bed Finder. This is how far you would have to travel as a child, adolescent, or adult for an open bed. Note that for children, this is often 270 miles away to Thief River Falls. You'll likely hear the opposition tonight say that building more beds is a step backwards. The fact remains that inpatient care is a proven, reliable way to save lives and change the course of an illness. There is no substitute for those in the greatest need. Community alternatives are fantastic whenever possible, but one size does not fit all. What I think we can all agree on doesn't work is our current state of revolving doors and rationing care. You'll also hear those that oppose adding capacity claim that other programs are the real solution. Again, one size does not fit all. Alternatives to inpatient care are not appropriate for most patients in an acute episode of a psychiatric disorder. Using Minnesota Department of Health's own numbers for how many admissions could be avoided, we will still be 20 to 30% short on the beds. And according to the MDH report, the fully funded alternatives will only result in an approximate 10% reduction in the need for more beds. You'll also hear that a freestanding facility may cost the state more money. I ask you, how much does it cost the state to build or lease 5 community behavioral health hospitals? How much does it cost to staff them? That's the amount of beds that we propose to add to the state without a single dollar of government money spent. The other offsets include tax revenues from our facility, reduced transportation costs for ambulance and police transports, reduced medical comorbidities of psychiatric patients, and the state not having to pay extended care MA patients in our facility. A recurring slander against our proposal is that Prairie St. John's will cherry-pick only the best patients. We are subject to federal EMTALA law, and it makes it a federal crime for us to cherry-pick. Our charity care rates rival the best in the Twin Cities, and it would be impossible for us to cherry-pick and achieve such high rates of charity care. Another concern we've heard relates to the medical capabilities of a freestanding facility. After lengthy discussion with the Minnesota Medical Association, our bill has been amended to satisfy their concerns, including medical capabilities. We will meet or exceed the community standard for medical capabilities on psychiatric units. We've heard the accusation that we will cause financial harm to other hospitals. There are only two possible ways of causing harm. One is by cherry picking, which we've already said we cannot do by law, and the other is by burdening others with medically complex patients. But we will be able to care for patients who are medically stabilized, just like every other psychiatric unit in the Twin Cities. If you take away a person's mental health disorder and you look at whether or not they would need to be hospitalized for their medical needs, if they wouldn't need to be hospitalized, we can care for them. Another accusation made against our proposal is that we will steal staff. We don't need to steal staff. This is our Fargo recruitment. Notice that we've recruited zero psychiatrists away from local hospitals. We haven't recruited in Fargo away from local hospitals, and we won't need to in the Twin Cities. We don't want to shut other units down. We need more beds, not the same beds shifted around to a different provider. The final allegation we've heard is that our chosen location avoids the poor. With two hospitals located on the same block, if our hospital was built, we expect MTC will extend their bus line to our facility and to Woodwinds. Also, ambulances and police would love to only have to drive to Woodbury. It is a much shorter trip to Woodbury from the Twin Cities downtowns than the ones that they're currently making to Thief River Falls, Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth, among others. You may hear these allegations again from the opponents to our proposal. They may try to convince you that we will damage the mental health care system in Minnesota, and nothing could be farther from the truth. Keep in mind, many of the opponents to this bill have one thing in common, a financial interest in keeping a bed shortage. It's easy to keep your beds full when there is no other option, no matter how good or how bad the care you provide. Please remember the data you've been presented. Remember the undocumented thousands that will suffer because they can't get help tonight, tomorrow night, and for the foreseeable future. I ask you vote to approve our proposal for the good of every citizen in Minnesota. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions now or once discussion on the bill begins.
Thank you, Dr. Ryan. We've already gone to about 18 minutes. Does the committee want to hear a few more minutes? We'll give both sides equal time. Are there two more witnesses? No. Okay. Then the opposition.
And I do have the A1 amendment. Yes. A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, which I wanted to present because I believe that it does address some of the concerns. It's the A1 amendment.
Senator Lynch moves the A1 amendment. Nope. Senator Erickson Ropes moves the A1 amendment.
Okay.
To put the bill in the shape the author wishes, is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Very loud speakers tonight.
And this...
And Senator Zogman, one of the proponents does have written testimony in our packets.
Okay. So thank you very much.
Members.
Okay. So this amendment, I can go over briefly if you don't mind, is to change one of the concerns of the health department was that it was large compared to the documented need. And so this addresses the feedback we received from the MMA, the Psychiatric Society, HCMC, Regents Hospital, Fairview, and Health East, that all hospitals take all patients regardless of insurance status, be open 24 hours a day, have doctors on staff to see patients 24 hours a day, handle the medically complex patients. It also changes the size of the request to 84 beds, and says that the hospital shall maintain at least 42 beds for the care of children and adolescents. So it does change the proposal to address many of the issues, concerns, and comments that we've received since this bill was introduced originally.
Senator Salzman, what was the, I can't remember how many original beds were
the original
children?
Bed was 144.
How many were for children originally?
I don't know that it noted that. Okay. Mr. Ryan?
It was 42. It's
still, in other words, that's not a change, this last clause.
It has not gone up, but it's a guaranteed not to go down, I guess. That was one of MPS's concerns.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion from the committee. If not, the opposition witnesses, please come forward. I don't know who wanted to come first. You guys can decide for yourself. Okay, go ahead. Just starting there, Ms. Abderholden, if you want to start, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden. I'm the executive director of NAMI Minnesota.
I'm Kathleen Kelso. I'm the director of public policy of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. And we're here together today because we represent two of the largest mental health advocacy organizations in the state of Minnesota. And combined, we have been lobbying and advocating for an improved mental health system, a comprehensive mental health system, for well over 100 years. We agree that there is a great problem in getting into psychiatric hospitalization. We agree that people shouldn't have to cover the entire state to get into a psychiatric hospital bed. However, we also understand that hospitalization is compromised by the fact that we do not have qualified and an appropriate number of psychiatrists and mental health professionals throughout the entire mental health system.
We also understand that there's a problem getting out. And so we know that there are people who are sitting in a hospital bed who don't need to be there. But we don't have enough intensive residential treatment services providers. We don't have enough treatment foster care. We don't have enough supportive housing. We don't have enough children's therapeutic services and supports. And sometimes we don't even have access to insurance. And that prevents people from moving out as well. So I think there's no disagreement anywhere in the state of Minnesota that there are problems, obviously, with the mental health system. What the next question should be, though, and should be seriously looked at, is what, then, is the solution? We think that we need to be very careful about seeing the only solution to our mental health problems, systems problems, as strictly more inpatient beds. This is the highest cost service for the service that people use for the fewest number of days in their over their lifetime. E. Fuller Torrey, who is hardly what you would call someone who is, I mean, he really supports a lot of hospitalization. He's from the Treatment Advocacy Center. And what he did is really talked about how do you determine how many beds a state should have. And to get to that, he raised some, I think, really good questions.
We'd like to encourage you to take the opportunity to look at the questions about what is the right number in distribution of psychiatric beds, residential and crisis beds in the state of Minnesota. What is the effect of successful community services upon the rate of admission to hospitals in the future? We know from our experience that successful community supports and adequately funded supports, when they're accessible, do lower the rate of admissions to psychiatric beds.
The other thing that Mr. Torrey raised is looking at short stay versus long stay, which, of course, you know, impacts how many days you can have someone in the hospital. And he said, really, it's a function of the availability of community services and quality discharge planning. And he specifically cited assertive community treatment teams, clubhouses, and community-based nurses as the way that you prevent hospitalizations and move people from longer stays to short stays in the hospital.
Something we all discussed thoroughly last year was the integration of health care. We learned that 80% of the people with psychosis requiring hospitalization also need physical health care. We have heard that small community hospitals already serving psychiatric patients have on occasion been unwilling or unable to admit patients with medical conditions that staff are not prepared to care for. Have we examined the extent of this problem? How do the psychiatric hospitals address comorbid conditions? In an aging population, this will only become more frequent.
And I don't think we can underestimate the problem of the workforce shortage. We have worked with the hospitals in the metro area. We have worked with the residency programs to try to get more residency slots. This is not an easy thing to get people to come to the Tundra. And you're talking about looking at, you know, perhaps the last number I heard, and now with the bed change, I'm not so sure, but it was 5 to 6 psychiatrists. That's a really large number to look for in Minnesota. And in conclusion, because we want to keep our time short, I mean, we did talk about, you know, frankly, the need to prevent people from ever needing hospitalization. We need to make sure that we get people out when they are done with their acute episode, that they're not sitting there waiting because there's nowhere else to go. Between the two of our agencies, we take thousands and thousands of calls every year from individuals with mental illness and families. We know the stories. We bring them to you. You know, every year, all during the session, we bring those stories to you. But over and over again, what we hear from families, what we hear from adults with mental illness, is we want more community services. We want more community-based crisis services. We want more residential services that are in the community. There are no easy, quick solutions. We have worked part of MHAG. We've had East Metro working groups. We have successfully brought changes and, you know, to transform our mental health system to you. There are no easy solutions. And what we want you to do is to look really, really carefully at this proposal, This is a huge, not only public investment, but private health care investment as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Whoever is next, please come forward.
Chairman Marty, Senators, thank you for allowing me to speak to you tonight. My name is Lisa Capel. I'm a psychiatrist. I work at the University of Minnesota primarily for the Department of Family Medicine. I have no personal or institutional vested interest in who profits from inpatient treatment or who controls inpatient treatment beds. My only interest is that effective and efficient care be delivered to the largest number of patients who need it. This is the reason why I became involved in the development of the ICSI Diamond Project, and I'm helping to implement that at the university clinics. I work in primary care clinics because that's where two-thirds of the patients who need mental health care receive it. I'd like to tell you that those are the less sick two-thirds, but that's not the case. These are severely ill patients who cannot find treatment anywhere else. They have nowhere else to go. You've all heard horror stories of patients sitting in the emergency room waiting for inpatient psychiatric beds. What you haven't been told about is the weeks
Dr.
or months
Capel,
before that.
Could you pull the mic a little bit closer?
Sorry. What you haven't been told about is the weeks or months before that when the patient was unable to get adequate care for their mental health issues. I see these patients every day, patients who are unable to see a therapist or have their medications effectively managed by a psychiatrist due to a shortage of providers, lack of health insurance, or inadequate coverage under mental health carve-outs. This problem is much less attention-getting than a patient sitting in an ER after a suicide attempt, but it's the fact that most mental health hospitalizations could be prevented by adequate outpatient care. I've been practicing for 18 years, long enough for some issues to come full circle. There wasn't always a shortage of inpatient beds. When I began practice, there were plenty of inpatient psychiatric beds, many of them operated by for-profit freestanding hospital chains such as the Charter Corporation. I don't know if any of you recall that. Inpatient treatment back then was covered relatively well. There were scandals involving cherry-picking of patients with good coverage by corporations like Charter. There was overuse of expensive inpatient benefits, and this triggered cuts by insurance providers. Ultimately, the Charter Corporation collapsed and went out of business, and many other inpatient beds were closed due to lack of funding. That is how we got in the situation we're in now. Now, I want to say a little bit about my experience with Perry St. John's. It began with the care of a 16-year-old patient, Alex, this is not his real name, obviously, who had been depressed and out of school for 18 months. He needed intensive family-based treatment with a high involvement by his mother due to complex family issues. I referred him to PSJ's day program, at first with relief that there was somewhere that this child could go. He did not need to be hospitalized. Prairie St. John's response was to hospitalize him in North Dakota for 2 months. No involvement with his family, no involvement with his outpatient provider, no improvement in his condition, and then he was discharged back with no communication to me, with nowhere to go. My colleagues tell me that this is not an isolated case with Prairie St. John's. We are all aware that resources for care are limited. Focusing those resources on a facility such as PSJ proposes will shift care of well-insured, healthier patients out of public nonprofit institutions. It is clear for the Department of Health that this will damage those institutions. Moving forward with this proposal may result in a net decrease of inpatient psychiatric beds as a result. PSJ would tell you that they will care for the poor and the elderly and the medically ill, but the fact remains that most of these patients will not have access to this facility. I have worked in psychiatric units that did not have general medical or intensive care wards available in the same building, similar to how this facility would be built. I can tell you categorically that I have seen patients become acutely ill and die because there was not adequate medical care available. That kind of crisis is not predictable. It does not occur during the day when a visiting internist is there and able to take care of the patient. As the population ages and becomes sicker, this will become an increasing concern. Aside from this, the basic issue is, how do you want to allocate scarce resources? Do you want the high-cost care for a few or better, more effective treatment for the majority? Universal health care, mental health parity, and increased intensive community initiatives like Diamond are the answer. Not high-cost, for-profit inpatient treatment. This is your choice. Focus on high-cost treatment available to a privileged few or use scarce resources to improve the overall delivery of mental health care. It is as if you discovered that many buildings in the Twin Cities had wiring defects that were causing them to catch fire and burn down. If you found this out, would you take resources away from repairing the problem? Would you take those resources and buy new fire engines? That's the solution that you endorse if you approve this proposal. Thank you for your time and attention.
You, Dr.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, my name is Kathy Knight. I'm a registered nurse and currently the Vice President for Fairview Behavioral Services. I am also the mother of a child who had about as severe a bout of depression as one can have and recover. Treatment of mental illness is not just a professional topic for me, but it's a deeply personal issue. Fairview Administration understands the need for and supports substantive change in mental health. The question is whether the proposed for-profit hospital in Woodbury represents the change needed. Fairview supports the Department of Health recommendation. I would like to make 3 points. First, on service need. Everyday patients of all ages are kept in locked psychiatric wards. These are isolating, intrusive, and even frightening environments by their nature. These patients are held often long past the point of their best interest. The system is also not serving those patients well. In a recent 6-week study, this happened to 42 children and adolescents at Fairview. Once acute care needs have been met, it is simply wrong to keep patients in the hospital for failure of mid-level service. Importantly, those 42 occupied beds reduced access for the young people who could have used them to meet acute needs. Provision of mid-level service access is right for those inappropriately hospitalized, as well as for those who could benefit from hospitalization. The second major driver of the bed access issue is provider availability. Provider shortage is the most frequent, by far, reason patients are deferred from Fairview. It is simply unrealistic to believe recruitment will come solely out of state when salaries are offered vastly in excess of the current market and the complexity and associated risks of the patient population are lower. The for-profit model does little to meet the needs of the most complex and costly cases. The mentally ill and homeless, detox-requiring medical support, long-term care, psychiatric, and medical complexity. On our medical units in 07, we added over 4,000 shifts of uncompensated care to address psychiatric management within the medical setting. A recent 7-state study found that persons with mental illness die on average 25 years earlier of their medical conditions than those without mental illness. We need to integrate care at all levels, not further silo mental illness from general health. In 2007, the legislature enacted significant mental health legislation. Implementation of this work will impact access, quality, and accountability within the system. This direction needs support and reinforcement. The proposal before you is a step backwards. Hospital beds represent the failed status quo. They are not a solution. They mask the real problems and misdirect the energy and resources needed to really improve care for the mentally ill in this community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brand, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, which is a provider organization that does outpatient and community-based services in around 125 locations scattered around pretty much every part of Minnesota. So we aren't in the business of doing hospital care, but rather the outpatient and community-based care. Just a few comments about this. In the end, we as an association come down and support the recommendations or the findings and recommendations of the health department on this, and let me explain a bit about why we come there. The project raises a set of difficult policy issues that we really haven't had to face here in Minnesota before. This is a type of proposal that we have not had on the table before. It's a big issue for mental health advocates, and it's a big issue for some of the community providers, and it's been difficult for me to prepare testimony for tonight. This proposal runs contrary to 30 years of advocacy and most of the current plans that are in place for developing a stronger community-based mental health system. Those plans tend to rely on better crisis care, better discharge planning and aftercare, and better, stronger early access to psychiatric and medical care and therapy prior to the crisis that we hear the stories about today. all of that requires us to have a good supply of high-quality professionals available. So community providers worry about will professionals, will good nurses, will good staff migrate to Prairie St. John's. We also worry that funding will be diverted and become even shorter supply in the community settings in which my members work. Are there beds needed? It's hard to listen to the stories of people who are in immediate need and to deny that there are times when beds are needed. People are in crisis. But it's a bit more complicated than that. Minnesota and the Twin Cities has many more licensed beds than are currently staffed and are and operational. Yet they are not being used because of problems of providing getting appropriate staff or having additional professionals or the funding problems associated with that. So why is it that we don't have the staffing available in the existing beds that are licensed? What happens is that there are shortages in the staffed beds and people are diverted all over. I think it would be interesting to look to see what are the client characteristics, what are the characteristics of the patients who are being transferred around the state. Are they more complex? Are they insured? Are they uninsured? What is it that leads to the inability or the difficulty in staffing the beds that do exist? Ultimately, what we have here is a situation where there's just poorly aligned incentives. It makes sense to have more hospital care. It becomes a profitable center, but the providers that I work with find that they can't make it work providing outpatient community-based services. Why is it so profitable, or why does it make so much sense to have increased hospitalization when the very services that would help alleviate our reliance on inpatient care are begging for support? Certainly more complex and costly patients will get concentrated in community hospitals. There are concerns that you've heard about how Prairie St. John's will respond to people in crisis and how the emergency care requirements would be handled, and whether or not we would have a situation where, again, that would lead to more difficult and perhaps more uninsured patients being concentrated in fewer and fewer organizations within the Twin Cities. And finally, this is an unusual situation for Minnesota to have a physician-owned hospital, a specialty hospital that comes before us. It's an area that has, you know, just quite frankly, has created concerns around the country about whether or not there are conflicts of interest in terms of self-referral and whether or not specialty hospitals are properly prepared to respond to people in emergencies. The U.S. House passed a law a couple weeks ago that would have prohibited Medicare and Medicaid patient payments for specialty hospitals that are physician-owned. And it's an area that I think is something we just haven't dealt with here in Minnesota before. I hope that we have a chance to work on this some more. There's certainly many, many problems in our system, and we would be glad to help be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The time of the opponents is up, but there is one other proponent who had come here on his own, not with part of it and so on, and we're going to take him. If you can keep yours to 1 minute, 1.5 minutes, please go ahead.
I'm Robert Sevenick. I'm a psychiatrist and medical director for behavioral health at Health East, and I appreciate the opportunity tonight. I just want to concur with my colleague before me and just state that I think building a hospital is a very expensive way to supplement for needed housing, medication, and crisis intervention, and it doesn't support the needs for the most vulnerable in our society, the mentally ill. I have some particular concerns about the patients who are medically complex that will not be served, and more importantly, those that become medically complex while at Prairie St. John's. This amendment doesn't require a physician on site, and even as amended, I don't think it addresses the fundamental problems with this bill. And I'll turn it over to Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Sarah Krieger. I'm the CEO of St. Joseph's, and I would just tell you we have a huge commitment to our psychiatric programs at St. Joe's. We know our issues need to be solved as a community, and we just urge you to really take seriously the recommendations of the Department of Health and solve for those programs that leave our mentally ill and chemically dependent patients getting the care they need, the right care they need, not in hospital beds if they don't need those. Let's get the people out that need to get out of the hospital, and let's have those beds available for the right patients. And then let's provide the right community services that help keep them in their homes. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Mr. Unglund, one of the proponent witnesses, had been told he could testify, and he didn't have a chance to, and he couldn't control the length of other speakers. So, Mr. Unglund, with the committee's indulgence, we'd like you to keep it to 3 or 4 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Marty.
Thank you very much for coming.
And committee. First, with the rescheduling, and when I explained it to my wife, she asked if she could testify instead. And some of you have heard me before. I thought it would be good to add another point of view from the family side. So with your indulgence,
please,
after
go ahead.
30
okay.
years and 2 days, let her
okay.
speak.
I'm going to change my whole
name.
Oh, Becky
yeah.
Unglund. Anyway, thank you for letting me speak. I've never done this before. I just want to tell a brief story of what happened to me when Mike was in the hospital. He was taken by ambulance because he was texting me suicide messages from the movie theater. I followed him there as quickly as I could. It was Fairview Riverside. The man there told me, the nurse told me, that he was so bad off that they thought they'd probably commit him to Anoka that next morning. I said, well, I think it's because he's drunk. And he wasn't a drinker, but since his crash 3 years before that, he would binge drink, then he would hurt himself, and that's how he'd end up in the hospital. There was never any follow-through on treatment, and I was isolated from any of his treatment due to the Privacy Act. So I signed a form saying I wanted to be involved. The Plymouth police came to my house the next morning really concerned because they thought Mike was in really bad state. I run a preschool out of my home, and they seemed very concerned about Mike coming home. And I didn't want to ruin that, and I knew that Mike was a good guy and he wasn't going to hurt any kids, but I said, I will see to it that he gets the treatment he needs this time. So when Mike called me, he had no remembrance of the suicide texts. And I said, Mike, they've told me multiple times when you've been in the hospital that you should get a chemical evaluation if this ever happened again. So he contacted his doctor. They called me, and they said that they would do that before he went home. The next day, he called, and he's going to take a cab home because he'd gone by ambulance. And he said the social worker told me that they were going to do that. Then he was having troubles in the hospital where they weren't going to do it. And I said, Mike, you have to do it, okay? I stood my ground on that. So he didn't show up at home. I called the hospital, and I asked if he was there. And they said to me, please listen to this, people. They said, he's not here, and hung up without letting me say a word. I was scared at that time because I knew that they hadn't treated me very well, and I was afraid they'd done something to my husband. But I thought it was a little crazy to think that. So I waited another hour, and I called again, and I said, may I talk to someone? And and they came back and said, he was given a cab voucher and sent home. 5 hours later, after I'd been to my daughter's, not telling my children that I didn't know where their dad was, I came home and he still wasn't home. I called a friend. She came over. We went through it in our minds. I said, I think the hospital did something to him. We thought it seemed crazy, but I got the guts to call back again at 11:30 when Nurse Arthur told me he wouldn't be able to give me that information because, get this, people, they shred the files. I was scared to death. And he said, they shred the files, but I'll go check. He came back and said that they had discharged him, given him a cab voucher, and I quote, if he didn't go home, it was his choice. I woke up at 7:30 the next morning, trying to figure out if Mike had, like, left me or what. I went and changed all of our credit cards and everything to find out hours later, after I was so distraught, I've been married to this man for 26 years. They had called the police, arrested him for trespassing, and he spent 4 hours or more in a restraint chair. Whether or not this bill is something that should be passed, I really don't know. I just know the system is major broken, that they have, that they were able to lie to me, and that as many times as Mike has told people, nobody's shocked by it, nobody really seems to care, and when I talked to the people at Fairview about it, they admitted that sometimes they do call the police. Why they didn't tell me, I don't know. Maybe it's a stress system. I was asked to talk pro. Maybe it's a stress system. Maybe that's why they went, they did this. Whatever the need, the reason, it wasn't right. And even if we don't get that other hospital, I think that Fairview and all the other hospitals should really be looked into. No, I can't read it because I don't have. Anyway, I'm done. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for taking the time to tell your story. We did get a handout from you.
Okay.
Oh, there's just this one sentence.
Sure.
What?
Yes, that one.
Oh. This is what was so weird, is then Mike went and got the records. And I was ready, by the way, just to say it's over. But if you've seen my husband before, it's not over for him. He can't get past it, you guys. I would like someone to tell him that this wasn't right. My life can't go on. I'm in graduate school now. I'm 54 years old. He can't work. I'm taking on two jobs. But the MD signed a form that said Mike had a little bit of a hassle or whatever they said, but he left. He finally capitulated and left on his own, which is a total lie. So something is major broken in the system, and nobody cares.
Ms. Unvin, thank you very much for sharing your story, and I think we all empathize with what happened, and I think it is something we have to work on.
And I don't think it only, I'm not foolish enough to think it's only happened to me.
Right. Thank you for sharing your story. Committee discussion or questions? Any of the witnesses with it? Quiet committee. Senator Salzman.
Well, I'd just like to say one thing, Mr. Chair, if I could, and it's not a rebuttal, but it's that, you know, this bill is not intended to fund the community-based services that we've heard are so desperately needed. But I do want to note that after people have made comments tonight regarding the fine professionals who serve the mental health community so very, very well, to have their intentions questioned by other healthcare facilities is disappointing. And I do want to note that Prairie St. John's has added more community-based services to the Twin Cities in the past 2 years than any other hospital system. So for those who came up tonight and talked, I appreciate that, but I don't think you came up with any solutions at all. You refused to see the problem, and you refused to see the needs of people who are traveling around this state who are in crisis. And until we can really address that problem, what are we going to do? So I just want to commend the Prairie St. John's staff who have worked so hard on this proposal, because their heart is truly in the right place. And Mr. Chair, if you would like, I would be happy to ask for this bill to be laid on the table.
I would so move.
Senator Berglund, I think if we can just lay it on the table right now, we don't need a vote on that. And I recognize, I mean, this is I think a lot of people here on both sides of the issue feel very strongly about it, and there are some differences, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it in coming months as well. So, Senator Salzman requests that we lay this bill on the table.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. I'd just like to say one thing. Senator Salzman, I appreciate you bringing the bill. And I just want to let you know, because I don't know if you know this, but a long time ago, I did serve as the head nurse on a psychiatric unit. So I have heard both sides, and there are extremely valid points on both sides. And when I hear criticisms of the other, sometimes it's just you kind of get in there, you're trying to win your argument, but I want to let you know that some of those things just sort of you have to let roll off and listen to really to what people are saying. And so I think a lot of the members on this committee really do understand and are sympathetic to everyone who came and spoke today. So I just want to honor all of you, all of the witnesses that came forward on both sides.
Yes, I think this discussion tonight showed, again, the need for a whole better mental health system, and there are lots of committed people working on it. But Senator Salzman, I thank you for bringing the bill as well. I think you help stimulate some good discussion here, and I'm sure it will be continuing both of this and onward. And with that, that's the last bill that was before us, and this is the deadline, the second deadline. So we will have the commissioner's confirmation hearing at some point soon, and may have. But basically, this is it for the committee this year. So thank you all very much for all your work. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.